Hello and welcome to Truth in Journalism, a radio broadcast dedicated to applying the Word of God to current events. Well, today on Truth in Journalism, we're going to talk about Holy War. Our story, which has been edited for length, is by Julia Carbonaro of Newsweek and is entitled, Bin Laden's Letter to U.S. Stuns Young Americans. He was right. A decades-old document allegedly written by Osama bin Laden entitled Letter to America recently went viral on TikTok, with some young Americans believing that the Al-Qaeda founder made valid points about their own country. The two-page document, which was published by The Guardian, is a letter bin Laden wrote in 2002 as a polemic against the U.S. and an explanation of the ideology that led him to orchestrate the 9/11 attacks. While the incendiary document is now 21 years old, some have seen the text as a way to make sense of current world affairs, including the Israel-Hamas war. Bin Laden's words have been described as mind-blowing and a revelation. A search for Letter to America on TikTok shows that some of the most popular related clips have over a million views each. It's wild and everyone should read it, said one TikTok user, warning that the letter had left her very disillusioned and confused. Another user talked of having an existential crisis after reading the document and having her entire viewpoint on life changed by it. It's actually so mind-blowing to me that terrorism has been sold as this idea to the American people, that this group of people, this random group of people, just suddenly wakes up one day and just hates you. It doesn't make sense, another TikTok user said. A few TikTok reactions to the letter show users recreating their joy at hearing of bin Laden's death in 2011, then contrasting it with their shock at reading the letter in 2023, adding the phrase, he was right. Bin Laden, the son of a wealthy Saudi businessman, founded Al-Qaeda, or The Base, in 1988 following the Soviets' defeat and withdrawal from Afghanistan, a conflict in which he fought. Under his leadership, the group launched several deadly attacks and bombings in various, including the attacks on September 11, 2001, where terrorists hijacked four airliners in the eastern U.S., crashing three of them against the two towers of the World Trade Center in New York and the Pentagon in Arlington, Virginia. The fourth plane crashed into a field in Pennsylvania. In October of the same year, bin Laden was added to the U.S. most wanted terrorist list. The 9/11 attacks killed nearly 3,000 Americans and injured thousands more. In the letter, bin Laden accused the U.S. of being responsible for the oppression of Palestinians because of its support for Israel. The creation and continuation of Israel is one of the greatest crimes, and you are the leaders of its criminals, bin Laden wrote. Each and every person whose hands have become polluted in this contribution towards this crime must pay its price and pay it heavily. The Saudi-born militant then wrote that Palestinians had to be revenged along with the people of Afghanistan. The U.S.'s purported role in the oppression of Palestinians and Muslims, according to bin Laden, was a justification for the murdering of American civilians. The American people are the ones who pay the taxes which fund the planes that bomb us in Afghanistan, the tanks that strike and destroy our homes in Palestine, the armies which occupy our lands in the Arabian Gulf, and the fleets which ensure the blockade of Iraq. Bin Laden wrote, this is why the American people cannot be innocent of all the crimes committed by the Americans and the Jews against us. The Guardian has since deleted the letter without offering an explanation. So I'm sure many of you have heard this news already, and it was part of a broader body of news about how absolutely insane the younger cohort of Americans is vis-a-vis politics and radical Islam. It seems that the Zoomers haven't quite yet figured out that the Islamic terrorists are the bad guys. I grant they aren't the only ones. Many moronic millennials and Gen X jabronis, and not a few buffoonish boomers, also don't think that the people who drive planes into buildings and plan for violent world domination and genocide are the black hats. They've fallen prey to a quite popular, albeit dim-witted, line of argument for moral equivalence. And many have already spoken at length about the folly of moral equivalence, so I won't say much, other than this is an entirely predictable result in a society that pushes moral relativism. If everything is relative and a matter of opinion, then can anything ever be righter or wronger? Obviously not to the true relativist, if such a thing is possible as a true relativist. The thoroughgoing moral relativist, a self-contradiction if there ever was one, a person who believes that all moral statements are relative to some standard and that those standards differ, and because they differ, we have to accept a plurality of standards, they will naturally, that person will naturally, I'd argue inevitably, come to the conclusion that the egregious sins of my friends are no worse than the minor sins of my enemies. And when I talk about thoroughgoing or true moral relativism, I'm talking about normative moral relativism, because it is important to distinguish between normative and descriptive moral relativism. Normative moral relativism says that there are no absolute moral standards. So if bin Laden wants to blow up civilians and exterminate the Jews, that's just his moral system working itself out. And hey, America's done bad things too, so we really can't determine whose side to be on. And that would be bad enough, but nature abhors a vacuum, which is why I said that a truly thoroughgoing normative moral relativist is a self-contradiction. Eventually, a moral standard will arise, an ethic will emerge, and so we have people who think that they're normative moral relativists, but in fact, they have an absolute moral standard that they wish to impose upon people, and that standard is wokeism with its anti-colonial, sexually libertine, intersectional, hierarchical viewpoint. And so these, mainly younger Americans, see bin Laden and ignore his Islamofascism and his desire to brutally execute homosexuals, throw women in sacks and make them subhuman and exterminate the Jews, and also conquer the world and subjugate it to Sharia. They'll ignore that and wash it away with normative moral relativism, but then they'll say that he's not just not wrong, but he's actually right because he's a non-white, non-Christian from outside the West. Therefore, he has to be higher on the intersectional hierarchy than the Jews or the people who were murdered on 9/11. Now, you might want to tut-tut me right now. Perhaps you're someone who's read a lot of Christianity Today, and you know all the ins and outs of intersectionalism and relativism, and you want to say, Luke, you fundy rube. That's an oversimplification, the worst sin of all, the oversimplification. The academic versions of these theories are much more nuanced and complex. You need to deconstruct your views and probably read some books. Yeah, no. There is such a thing as straw manning, where you take the weakest form of an opposing position and attack it, and that's dirty pool in the academy. The academy prefers steel manning, where you deal with the strongest possible version of an argument, even a possible version that your opponents haven't proposed, because you want to deal with the best possible version of an argument. And that's very popular in intellectual circles. And when you're writing for an academic audience, that really is the way to go. But there's also something I like to call real manning. I'm not interested in arguing against the most precise form of these arguments as they exist in captivity away from the consequences of life. I'm interested in these arguments and ideas as they exist in the wild. I want to talk about what these views look like when they're tested by life, because here's the thing. Perhaps I am being overbroad when I critique moral relativism and its relationship to woke ideology and intersectionalism and moral equivalence. But I'm not talking about academic philosophers here. I'm talking about your friends and neighbors, people who can vote. And the reality, tragic though it may be, is that there are lots of Americans whose minds have been so corrupted by corrosive ideologies that they are literally defending and agreeing with people who murdered thousands of their fellow citizens and are calling for the extermination of the Jewish people and the violent conquest and subjugation of the world. And friends, the days of just dismissing these people as a few cranks are long since gone. They are too many to ignore. And this is a problem. And this is a problem for many reasons, not least of which is that because we are in a holy war. The West is currently engaged in a holy war against Islam. Now, perhaps you're saying, but Luke, I don't want to be in a holy war against Islam. I'm against war and wars of religion in particular. Me too. But here's the thing. It only takes one side to make a holy war. This isn't like selling a home where both sides have to agree to the terms. If one side, and only one side, wants a war of religion, then they can have a war of religion. And at that point, your choices are really two: fight back or surrender. There isn't really a third way. But here's the other thing, or one of the other things, and this is the main point. This is what I want to talk about. Secularism, in all its many forms, cannot win in a holy war against Islam. Secularism has no capacity to resist Islam. Islam has a purpose. It has a raison d'être. Secularism has none. Islam has a coherent moral system. Secularism does not. Islam has a desire to live. Secularism does not. Now, please, don't mistake me for saying Islam is good or right or true. I'm saying nothing of the sort. And I'm not saying Islam is not facing major real problems. It is. Suicide rates in Muslim countries are not negligible, and the fertility rate among Muslims is also declining. What I'm not saying is that Islam is good. I'm not saying it is. What I'm saying is that secularism is not capable of winning a war of attrition against Islam. Islam functions today similarly to how communism functioned in the 1920s and 80s in the West. Westerners, by and large, didn't go for it. But there were many who were enticed by its promises, and the Western social structure was challenged by communism and forced to answer hard questions. Communism, in the sense of Marxism-Leninism, and the USSR wanted to colonize the world with a worldwide system that had a clear and articulable utopian vision. It offered something to live for and something to fight for and something to die for. Never mind that it was a foolish and impossible and immoral dream. That's not relevant. What is relevant is that it had multitudes of people led astray by the promises of a better world because they had failed to believe that what they had was worth living and fighting and dying for. Russia embraced Marxism-Leninism because the Tsarist system had been so oppressive and abusive, and the lives of average Russians was so bad that they believed that it couldn't get worse. It could, and did. But at least Lenin and Stalin and the boys promised something worth suffering for. They promised a future of peace and plenty. Sure, you had to liquidate the kulaks to get there and starve a bunch of Ukrainians, but that's small potatoes compared to perfect equality and prosperity. The Russian system was morally and societally bankrupt and had no immunity to communism. Today, Islam is willing to fight, kill, and die, and to keep fighting, killing, and dying until the whole world bends the knee to Allah and is subject to Sharia as part of the Ummah. Muslims who really believe in this have lots of kids so that they can swell the ranks of the Mujahideen. They will willingly suffer and go without to ensure future victory. Islamists are willing to sacrifice the present to win a glorious future. It has something that gives people purpose. In short, Islam has a goal that transcends the individual, gives purpose to suffering, and has moral clarity, if not moral truth. What does secularism have in response to this? More sexual perversion? More deviancy? More pronominal tyranny? Are we really so foolish to think that a society of queer activist social justice warriors stand any chance in a protracted war against the Mujahideen? The Islamofascists are willing to blow themselves up to kill their enemies. The Knights of Secularism get triggered if you call them a snowflake. And now we come to the awkward part of this sermon. We come to the point where one must ask, old Lukey Poo, what then am I suggesting? Or rather, what do I think the Bible is calling Christians to? And that's a difficult question, and it's difficult because Christians are being called to be like Christ, and that means a lot of different things. So there are a couple things that we can use as poles or foundations or fixed points. First, we can say that as a starting point, Islam as a religion is fundamentally, unchangeably, and violently opposed to secularism. Second, Islam desires to impose Islam worldwide. Third, secularism cannot win a protracted war against Islam. Fourth, and this has been implied but not stated explicitly, so I say it now, only Christianity is able to resist Islam. So given those fixed points, what am I suggesting? Violent conquest of Muslim lands? No, nothing of the sort. A return to Christendom? I might think that that's an interesting political theory, but I don't think you can get there in a straight line via the Bible. There's no verse of scripture that tells nations to establish a multinational Christian politico-military coalition. And what's more, I think such a thing would develop organically anyways, because it has. I think that's inevitable. Whether such a coalition does more harm than good is a question of speculative historians. And me, when I'm feeling spicy, but that's not today. Moreover, what I'm not saying is that I want America to become Christian to save America. And I know that I've talked about this a lot over the years, but there is a very fine and important distinction between wanting to see nations flourish and prosper as a result of their becoming godly and wanting nations to be godly so that they can flourish and prosper. It's a fine line, but it is there and it's fairly clear. And to confuse them is to confuse means and ends. So what am I suggesting? I'm merely suggesting that the lack of resistance that the secular West has to Islam is proof of the bankruptcy of secularism and our need for Christ. Blue Like Jazz joked about a group on a fictional college campus called Jews for Jihad. Such jokes no longer land. And that is the sad and tragic result of godlessness. Living in a post-satirical culture is the inevitable conclusion of Christlessness. The tragedy is that the farther from God we are, the more serious and strong we feel, but the more enfeebled and beclowned we truly are. Someone somewhere said that professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Let's strive to live in a world where satire is funny and not tragicomic. Let's strive to live in a nation that loves life and goodness and has purpose. Let's seek after Christ. And all these things will be added unto us as well. I hope and pray we will. And I hope you'll join us again next time for another exciting episode of Truth in Journalism. Thank you, and may God bless your day to His glory.